Coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Iranian officials say that all 66 people on board one of its domestic airliners were killed after it crashed into the Zagros Mountains. A spokesman says the dead are 60 passengers, including a child, as well as six crew members. The flight had left Tehran Sunday morning for a city, a flight of about 560 kilometers. The Iranian Red Crescent said it had deployed teams to the area, but the weather was reported to be bad and helicopters could not land near the crash site. Decades of international sanctions have left Iran with an aging commercial airline fleet, and accidents have increased in recent years. Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, called Iran the world's greatest threat and said that Israel would act against Tehran during some of his comments made earlier.
Holding a piece of what Netanyahu said was an Iranian drone after its incursion into Israeli airspace, he told the Munich Security Conference, Israel will not allow the regime to put a noose of terror around our neck. In his first address at the annual Munich Security Conference, Netanyahu urged his audience to counter Iran immediately, displaying a map showing what he said was Iran's growing presence in the Middle East. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif called Netanyahu's presentation a cartoonish circus. Steve Miller, VOA News.
212 undocumented immigrants have been arrested in Southern California over the past week, according to the U.S. federal government. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency says that they arrested the 212 at 122 businesses during a five-day sweep. In its statement, it said that because sanctuary jurisdictions like Los Angeles prevent ICE from arresting criminal aliens in the secure confines of a jail, the officers are forced to conduct at-large arrests in the community. This is VOA News. More demonstrations from students responding to a deadly shooting rampage that occurred last week in Florida. Emma Gonzalez is a survivor of the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. She spoke at a Florida gun control rally Saturday, 3 days after the armed former student killed 17 of her classmates and teachers. Other students joined her as well.
Despite being tipped off to the FBI multiple times, he was able to legally purchase an AR-15. He was able to legally purchase that semi-automatic rifle and come into my school and slaughter 17 of my people. Because of these gun laws, people that I know, people that I love have died, and I will never be able to see them again.
Gonzalez spoke bluntly to her audience, hundreds of people who gathered at the Fort Lauderdale Federal Courthouse, about 45 kilometers from the suburb where the shooting took place. Moscow has dismissed U.S. charges against several Russian citizens and companies for meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Speaking at the Munich Security Conference, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov questioned the evidence, and Henry Ridgewell reports from Munich.
Moscow's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov did not directly mention the U.S. indictments in his speech.
You know, I have no reaction at all because one can publish whatever one wants. We see how accusations, statements, allegations multiply. Until we see the facts, everything else is just blather.
U.S. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster said the United States has learned how to fight back.
The United States will expose and act against those who use cyberspace, social media, and other means to advance campaigns of disinformation, subversion, and espionage.
Henry Ridgewell for VOA News at the Munich Security Conference, Germany.
Israel has responded with airstrikes against six Palestinian targets after an improvised explosive device blew up near the Israeli-Gaza border fence, injuring four Israeli soldiers, two of them seriously. One of the targets includes what the military said was a weapons manufacturing site and underground tunnel being built in the direction of Israel. Two Palestinians were injured in the raids. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the explosion on Israel's southern frontier, with the territory controlled by the Islamist group Hamas. Roger Federer has celebrated his impending return to the top of the world rankings by winning the Rotterdam Open on Sunday. This is now his 97th title. The 36-year-old, the oldest ATP number one in history, thrashed the Bulgarian Grigor Dimitrov 6-2, 6-2 in a one-sided final. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
First of all, I think politicians always do, you know, that kind of thing. If they think that it's failing in his executive function, they'll always, make such calls.
Zambian presidential press secretary rejects opposition plans to impeach President Lungu.
There has been an outpouring of condolence messages, an outpouring of emotion. You know, Morgan Tsvangirai was a people's person, a grassroots person, a very simple person with enormous popular appeal.
Zimbabwean former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai to be buried Tuesday.
We must make sure that the President Sam Kyi, First Vice President Thabane Ndengai, and then Vice President Yemi Vuaniga remain intact because we have a harmonious president working together.
And the South Sudanese civil society and opposition groups reject a government proposal in the revitalization process. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Zambian presidential press secretary says plans by opponents of President Edgar Lungu to impeach him will fail. Amos Chanda says it's unlikely the opposition lawmakers will succeed in their plans to impeach the president in parliament. He dismissed suggestions that the president has repeatedly contravened the constitution, which opponents say are enough grounds to move a motion in parliament to impeach him. For analysis, I reached Mwenge Chivwembe, executive director of the Foundation for Democratic Process, or FODEP, an NGO in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
First of all, I think politicians always do, you know, that kind of things. If they think that it's failing in the executive functions, they'll always, make such calls. But from our perspective as an NGO, we always want to see whether indeed their calls are firmly grounded. And in this case, the president on a number of times has been challenging those who have been calling on him to step down because they feel that he and his administration are involved in corrupt practices. But I think the general populace right now may not be convinced because it has been difficult for those leaders to produce evidence pointing to the fact that there is corruption in the administration.
Legally, do you think they have the proof or they've been able to convince Zambians that indeed President Edgar Tsvangirai Lungu has contravened the constitution such that this provides them the grounds to impeach him in parliament?
Not at all. Not convincing grounds. But that is not to say that our governance space has not been challenged by a number of issues. I think we are at a time when we are at the eve of a national dialogue because of a number of gaps in the governance that, you know, stakeholders have observed. But recently, regarding those calls to say that the president ought to step down because of corruption, the Zambian people have not been really convinced with cold facts pointing to the fact that perhaps himself and indeed his administration are involved in corrupt practices. And that could be confirmed by also the independent state institutions such as the Anti-Corruption Commission, who have not indicted any of these cabinet ministers. So I think that has left the Zambian people in a limbo, you know, whether to actually agree with such cause, because there is really actually no evidence that has been put forward convincingly to the Zambian people. But that is not to say there haven't been challenges in the governance space. That is why we are at a time when we are talking about reforming some of the laws that have not made our governance space to really be free for the opposition and indeed the party that is in power.
Do these opposition political parties have the numbers in parliament to even succeed if indeed that is their plan to impeach the president?
Not at all. They actually do not have. You see, what happened in the 2016 elections was that the PF, of course, got the majority. I think they have about 85 members of parliament. And also, there was about 11 independent members of parliament, which, were from the PF stronghold. And apparently, from the look of things, these, you know, couldn't be adopted on the PF ticket, but of course the electorates gave them the mandate. But in principle, they are also on the side of the PF. So really the numbers, they do not have. But I think the opposition are making a good moral appeal, you know, whether indeed they do have evidence, you know, to actually make a very strong case. I think that is doubted.
On social media platforms and some opposition media groups in Zambia, talking about the moral appeal and the ridicule and the way they disparage the president, do you think they are making their case and Zambians are reacting to them positively?
Well, it's really very difficult right now to judge because, you know, of course, social media has got a very lean, you know, coverage in Zambia because only a few people do have access to social media. And the majority of the Zambian people do not have access to social media. But I think over and above all these discussions emanating from the opposition camp, I think what is missing is really the evidence. It's really a convincing narrative which an ordinary Zambian can actually agree with. Of course, there's been a lot of public outcry on some number of public procurements. For instance, the fire tenders that were bought at a very humongous amount, which raised a number of eyebrows. But again, all these things have been done within the correct procedure. So that makes even the work of the Anti-Corruption Bureau, you know, very difficult to actually pinpoint where the problem was. So I think the narrative has been there. There's been, you know, some outcry in pockets of society. But it's been very difficult actually to convince the majority whether indeed there is corruption happening in this sense or indeed it is just actually a perception that is, you know, they are peddling against the president.
Mwenge Chivwembe is the executive director of the Zambian Foundation for Democratic Process, or FODEP. He spoke with me from Lusaka. Zimbabwean former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai will be buried Tuesday. Before his death, Tsvangirai was the leader of the main opposition party, Movement for Democratic Change, or MDCT. The 65-year-old Tsvangirai died Wednesday in South Africa after a long battle with cancer. Tsvangirai formed the MDC in 1999 to challenge President Robert Mugabe, who was forced out of office in November when a military uprising ended his 37-year hold on power. For the latest on the burial of the former prime minister, I reach Obet Gutu, spokesman for the MDCT in the capital, Harare.
President Emmerson Mnangagwa and his two vice presidents, they were here. They came here around local time. Around 11:30 a.m. This morning. The two vice presidents came a few minutes after President Mnangagwa, the first vice president to follow President Mnangagwa's vice president Chiwenga. Then in came Vice President Kemba Mohadi. They paid their condolences to the Tsvangirai family and also obviously to the party. And they made a few, President Mnangagwa made a short speech. And obviously, two representatives from the present family, from President Tsvangirai's family, also, you know, gave some two short speeches. So from here, I'm actually speaking right now. I'm still at President Tsvangirai's residence in Highlands, Harare. We are now going to travel to, obviously, to Nkomanda barracks, where his body will be collected, and will then be taken to the Methodist Church in the suburb of Membarane here in Harare for a church service. And the church service, I'm told, will last about maybe 2 hours or so. And after the church service, the body will then be taken to Harvest House, where thousands of party supporters are already congregating. It will be at Harvest House maybe for about 30 minutes or so. And then the body will then be, you know, brought home to lie in state overnight.
Obet, when is the official burial?
The official burial is there on Tuesday, Tuesday afternoon at his rural home, Humanikwa village in the Bohoira district of Manicaland province. So it's Tuesday afternoon.
How has been the reaction of Zimbabweans as this funeral process continues?
There has been an outpouring of you know, condolence messages, an outpouring of emotion. You know, Morgan Tsvangirai was a people's person, a grassroots person, a very simple person with enormous mass popular appeal. So people from all walks of life have been congregating at his residence here, where I'm talking to you from. They've been here for the past 2-3 days. They've come here to pay their last respect. So there's been a massive, I would say, almost an unprecedented show of sympathy on the said passing on of President Tsvangirai.
Some Zimbabweans I spoke with earlier were wondering if former President Robert Mugabe would express his condolence with his family as well. Have you heard anything?
Not as yet. Maybe he will. Maybe he has. Because we have organized a condolence book. There's a condolence book here at the residence. There's also a condolence book at our party head office at Harvest House in downtown Harare. But I haven't, officially heard whether former President Robert Mugabe has paid his condolences yet. But look, the funeral is still ongoing. We still have 2 days to go. Also, maybe he'll be paying his last respect.
What impact do you think his Morgan Tsvangirai's death will have on the party, following how important he was to the party?
Look, he was a very important figure. He was an iconic figure, and it's obvious that his death is irreplaceable. It's very sad. It's very unfortunate. He was the founding president. He galvanized the party, grew it over the years into becoming arguably the largest and most popular political party in Zimbabwe. So, look, Morgan Tsvangirai is going to be a difficult person to replace. There's no doubt about that. But we will forge ahead. We will strive to remain united. He left us a legacy of empathy, a legacy of love, a legacy of unity, a legacy of solidarity. So we just hope that we will have to honor him by continuing as a figure.
Ahead of the election, what impact do you think his death would have? Because some people are expressing concern that there could be possible split within the MDC even before
his
burial.
I don't think so. Of course, you always get a prophet of doom. But we are the leaders. We'll try to find one another. We'll try to bridge whatever differences that are there. And I'm pretty confident that going forward, as soon as the burial, of course, the leadership will have to sit down and meet. And I'm pretty confident, and in fact, very, 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 optimistic that the party will remain as one unit, and that the party will remain united, and that we'll enter the elections as one, strong political party.
What is the MDC's message to the people of Zimbabwe as the funeral of former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai continues?
Our message to the people of Zimbabwe is that they should remain peaceful. Morgan was a man of peace. He was a man of love. He abhorred violence. That's why he consistently, always portrayed the message of peace, to say even if we might have political differences, we should never, ever resolve our political differences through violent means. He was a man who was a victim of state-sponsored violence himself. He suffered at the hands of the state, personally. And he really appreciated the harm and the pain of playing the dangerous game of the politics of violence. So I would say to the people of Zimbabwe, in honor of the legacy of the late Morgan Tsvangirai, we should soldier on peacefully. Whatever political contestations we should have should always be done in a peaceful manner. If there are differences, even if there are different political parties, politicians contesting for political office, you should never, ever, ever resort to violence. We should always have a peaceful, political contestation. I think that will be the greatest, legacy. Or thank you, if I may put it that way, to Morgan Tsvangirai's legacy.
Obed Gutu is the spokesman for the Zimbabwean main opposition, MDCT. He spoke with me from Harare. Meanwhile, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa has described the country's late opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai as a brave man. The former prime minister died in neighboring South Africa last Wednesday, where he was being treated for colon cancer. For VOA, Sebastian Mhofu has more from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
President Emmerson Mnangagwa said Air Force jets would fly the body of Zimbabwe's former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai to his rural home for burial Monday after body viewing. "We are together in mourning. I'm receiving messages of condolences from all over the world on the passing away of Mr. Tsvangirai. That is a good thing. He traveled a very difficult life, but he managed it. So let us unite," he said. Former Kenyan Prime Minister Raila Odinga was among those the Movement for Democratic Change said was attending Tsvangirai's church service Sunday. In 2008, his MDC party defeated then President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF party in elections, forcing a runoff between the two leaders. But Tsvangirai pulled out at the last minute, citing massive violence targeting his supporters. The African Union later nullified a victory claimed by Mr. Mugabe. The move resulted in a Zimbabwe coalition government which lasted until 2013 elections, in which the MDC was defeated by the ruling ZANU-PF party. In his condolences, U.S. Ambassador to Zimbabwe Harry Thomas Jr. said of Tsvangirai,
"Morgan's influence was not only in Zimbabwe, not only in Africa, but throughout the world, where he showed that somebody could rise from humble beginnings as a trade unionist, as a leader for union rights and labor rights, to a leader for democracy. And I think that his example that we see in so many young Zimbabweans who are trying to effect change is because Morgan withstood brutal beatings, brutal accusations, the loss of his wife. And those things will be his legacy, that he never compromised his principles to gain power. He did what he needed to do to save lives and to help democracy. So may his soul rest in peace. May he believe that his work was well done, and may Zimbabweans go to the polls in record numbers in tribute to his belief in democracy."
Zimbabwe goes to elections around mid-2018. The MDC party has already appointed one of Tsvangirai's deputies, Nelson Chamisa, as its acting leader for the next 12 months. It is not clear yet what Tsvangirai's passing will mean for the party's fortunes. But many say a leadership struggle in the opposition MDC would greatly enhance the ruling party's chances of winning again. Sebastian Mhofu for VOA News, Harare.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
South Sudanese civil society and opposition groups have rejected a government proposal in the revitalization process organized by the regional bloc Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD. The administration in Juba insists that President Salva Kiir and his two deputies will maintain their positions in a transitional government. But the opposition groups say the proposal demonstrates that the government is tone deaf and unwilling to stop the ongoing conflict. The South Sudanese Petroleum Minister Ezekiel Lol Gatkut, who was part of the government negotiating team, told me one of the aims of the proposals is to bring peace to all South Sudanese.
When the revitalization forum was launched by the IGAR heads of state and government to revitalize the agreement that we have signed in 2005, there was a proposal that there are some strange groups, those who are outside the implementation of the agreement, they must be brought on board so that we implement the agreement fully. So, and that is the genesis of the revitalization forums. And what we are proposing is that since we are coming to implement the agreement, all of us together, and everybody must be included, is one, we must make sure that the President Salva Kiir, First Vice President Taban Dengai, and then Vice President James Wanida remain intact because we have a harmonious president working together. Then we are proposing that there are four positions that we need to create assistance to the President of the Republic. And these positions can be divided between the opposition and the transitional government of national unity.
But Ezekiel, from the proposal I'm seeing, the government appears not to be making any concessions at all to bring on board. It's like relegating other opposition groups to the background, irrespective of this revitalization process. Basically, the government wants to eat its cake and have it.
You know, the idea of revitalization is to include everybody into the implementation of the agreement. How do you include? Well, you include by creating positions and by actually expanding the government so that everybody is involved. But if you say you are going to exclude some people who are actually in the government now, then it will not be inclusion. So the inclusivity, which is actually the base of the revitalization, will not be realized. So you maintain what is there now. And then you bring others on board by expanding the government.
If you have the top positions already occupied, with the government insisting that it already has a harmonious leadership, then what is the point of the revitalization process? You have Dr. Riek Machar, the former first vice president, who has been relegated, the government demanding that he renounces violence, else he will not even be allowed to come into the country. Some of these things are exclusion and not in the narrative that the government is proposing.
You know, peace agreements worldwide, they are not tied to individuals. They are not tied to individuals. We had an agreement in 2005, and John Garang passed on, unfortunately, and Salva Kiir became the leader, and we continue implementing. If Riek Machar is actually not in the process of implementing the agreement, Taban Dengai has been elected by the SPLM in opposition. He is now implementing the agreement. Those who are out, Riek can wait for the election. But those who are following Riek Machar can actually be involved by bringing them on board, participate in the implementation of the agreement, vote for election. If Riek Machar is very popular, then he will actually run for election, and then he will be elected. But I'm afraid his popularity has diminished. If he's going to challenge President Salva Kiir, definitely President Salva Kiir will actually have even over 90%.
Now, you also have a case of James Gadet, the former spokesman of the SPLM-IO. There are speculations that the president will pardon him and claim that he's a man of the people, a man of peace, and then release him. And this is all a charade. There appears to be no commitment, no political will from the government to ensure the peace returns to the country. Why is this so?
Well, we are very committed to make sure that peace is realized. Even us, we are not even waiting for a revitalization forum. My president declared a national dialogue. We are dialoguing ourselves, so we reconcile and we build our country by bringing peace first to the people of South Sudan and reconciling it so that we have peace. South Sudanese, actually, they belong to South Sudan. They don't belong to the region or to the international community. We ourselves, we are the one to bring peace. Concerning the case of James Gadet, you know, judiciary is independent anywhere in the world. And we want to make sure that the due process of law
is it. The judiciary in South Sudan is not as independent as the government would want people to believe, and that the judiciary always succumbs to the whims and caprices, the opposition says, of President Salva Kiir Mayardit.
You are actually even forgetting the person that you are talking to. I was actually charged with treason. And then I was acquitted by the same judiciary. So judiciary is independent. James Gadet will use all the legal means to get himself free. And then it will be brought to the president for clemency, if you wish so.
Ezekiel Lol Gatkut is the South Sudanese Petroleum Minister. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, some new tiny pacemakers are making headway around the world. One type is keeping 15,000 people's hearts beating in 40 countries. Studies show these small pacemakers are safe. And as VOA's Carol Pearson reports, doctors expect the technology will help more heart patients over time.
A healthy heart has its own pacemaker that establishes its rhythm. But some people, like Mary Lou Trejo, need the help of an artificial pacemaker.
My heart does not beat regularly. It skips beats, and sometimes it's normal, and then all of a sudden it just goes out of rhythm.
At Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, Trejo became one of the first patients in the United States to have a pacemaker that's only 24 millimeters long implanted in her heart. This device is one-tenth the size of traditional pacemakers. Most pacemakers rely on batteries placed under the skin. They use wire leads with electrodes on one end that are threaded through blood vessels to connect to the heart. Dr. Ralph Augustini at Ohio State says this tiny pacemaker simplifies that.
The electrodes are part of the can, and therefore it eliminates the lead.
Augustini implanted Trejo's pacemaker as part of a clinical trial in 2014. He threaded the entire device through an artery in her leg up to the heart. Cardiologist John Hummel has studied the effectiveness of this new generation of pacemakers.
We don't leave any wires behind, and the pacemaker, the battery, the wire is all just a tiny little piece of metal sitting down in the heart.
There's no surgery involved, so the entire process is safer, according to studies on the microbrand which Trejo had implanted, and another type made by St. Jude Medical. Dr. Richard Wechter has implanted the Micra in patients at the University of Missouri Hospital.
The complication rates in general for a leadless pacemaker to date have been about half what a traditional percutaneous pacemaker would have.
The battery on this pacemaker can last for 14 years. After that, doctors can implant another one into the same chamber of the heart and repeat it a third time if needed. Doctors have called these devices revolutionary. As for Mary Lou Trejo, 4 years after her surgery, her doctors say she is doing just fine. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The football governing body FIFA has named a four-man investigation unit to probe potential match-fixing in Sierra Leonean football. The match-fixing inquiry includes a World Cup qualifier between Sierra Leone and South Africa in 2008. Since 2014, 11 officials and 4 players have been suspended by Sierra Leone's Football Association, pending investigation, with all having denied wrongdoing. The current Sierra Leone Football Association executive will welcome the news, with its president Isha Johansson having long pushed for a match-fixing inquiry to go ahead. Central to the investigation is the 2010 World Cup qualifier that ended goalless between South Africa and Sierra Leone in South Africa in June 2008. Meanwhile, two-time continental champions Etienne Setif of Algeria thrashed Central African Republic's Olympique Rib Bangui 6-0 in the first leg of their Champions League preliminary round tie. Zakaria Hodechi grabbed a hat-trick for host Setif, including one from the penalty spot. Akram Jahanit adding a brace, with Maloud Rabai also on the score sheet. There was an historic win for LICR of Liberia on Sunday as they beat visiting Sudan's Al Hilal, who are two-time runners-up, 1-0, thanks to a goal from Sharif Sheku. Another Algerian side, Malodia Alga did not fare so well as they lost 2-0 to Congolese hosts Otoho. Nigerian debutants Plateau United made a winning start to their campaign with a comfortable 3-0 win over visiting Ending Sport of Cameroon. Another Nigerian side making their debut were Mountains of Fire and Miracles, who are bankrolled by a popular Pentecostal church, managed a 1-1 draw at RIB Bamako of Mali. The second legs of the ties are said to be played on Tuesday and Wednesday, February 20th and 21st. In the Confederation Cup, Morocco's Renaissance Bakken beat visiting Mbo Petit Court of Senegal 2-1 in the first leg of the preliminary round tie. Asante Kotoko of Ghana edged Caro of Congo-Brazzaville 1-0 on Sunday. In tennis, Roger Federer became the oldest world number one in tennis history 14 years after he first topped the rankings. The 36-year-old beat Robin Haase 4-6, 6-1, 6-1 in the last eight of the Rotterdam Open to replace Rafael Nadal at the top of the standings. Federer surpassed Serena Williams, who was 35 when she lost her women's number one ranking in May of last year. Eight-time Grand Slam winner Andre Agassi previously held the men's ranking record. He was 33 when he lost the number one spot in September of 2003. Federer first became world number one in February 2004, but has not topped the ranking since October 2012 and slips to a low of 17th in January of last year. That was after he spent 6 months out recovering from an operation on a knee problem. However, he has since won 8 titles, including Wimbledon last year and 2 Australian Opens. Finally, Ethiopia has named the team for IAAF Trinidad Alfonso World Half Marathon Championships Valencia 2018. Among those named on the team are Ethiopia's fastest man and woman over 13.1 miles this year. 6 months after finishing fifth over 10,000 meters at the IAAF World Championships London 2017, 21-year-old Jamea Imeh made an impressive half marathon debut in Ras Al Khaimah earlier this month. He finished second in 59 minutes, the fastest time by an Ethiopian runner since 2012, and putting him third on the Ethiopian all-time list. Ruta Aga, winner of the Houston Half Marathon earlier this year, leads the women's team. The 24-year-old, who finished second at last year's Berlin Marathon, won Houston with a big personal best of 1 hour 6 minutes and 39 seconds to move fourth on the Ethiopian all-time list. The top four finishers from the Ethiopian Half Marathon Championships joining Aga on the team are Zeneba Ima, Meseret Belete, Belekech Gudeti, and Zinash Mekanani. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Everybody got to open your mind. anything that happen for me like now. Yeah, if you know they play, how come you don't say you don't feel like come on? Everybody say it's a bad time, time, time. Yeah, everybody got to open your mind. Yeah, 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 yeah. It's love in this blind, blind. Truly, I really know that love in this blind. Yeah, if you know they play, how come you don't see anything that happen for me like now? Yeah, if you know they play, how come you don't say you don't feel make up your mind? Everybody say. In a relationship between a man and a woman, oh, them go just to deceive themselves. Them say them love one another all the time. The other wanna get another baby, yeah. The other wanna get another baba, oh. The other wanna get another girl. He will go make them just say happy. She get another half a time. I'm talking from experience, eh. Oh, we are living in pretense, eh. If you think so, I don't lie, my brother, man, I beg make you stop your conscience, eh. Oh, we all just. Jehovah in heaven is directing. Yeah, hey, my brother, man, I step by step. Make you play your role, make I play my role. When I say, it's a fucked up thing. Everybody got to open your mind. Everybody's love is blind. Truly, I really know that love is blind. Yeah. If you know they're blind, how come you don't see when things they happen for me? Yeah. If you know they're blind, how come you don't see when things they happen for me? Everybody say, it's a fucked up thing.
See, this type of something happens everywhere. All of us know this, but some of us just don't want to care. We don't want to face reality, cause the truth is bitter sometimes, see my brother. We start to fake it, fake it, fake your life, fake life. We start to scatter, my brother. We just looking as a people pretending day by day. Nobody want to say the truth, but this I must say. Me and Timaya, we look the people like disciples of Jesus. Some of them are Peter, some of them like Judas. Some of them are doubting Thomas. Some of them are act like Elijah. Some of them are
Pharaoh. Everybody got to open your mind. This love is blind. Truly, I really know that love is blind.
Looking at me like a nigga, this world is a stage. Judas, we all are just acting with players, man. Passing the ball, at the next level. Onto the matter now. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Don't reach that time. Don't reach that time.
Open up your eyes, man.
It's about that time. It's about that time.
Havana. You understand? DJ. Yeah, yeah.
Scatter my brain, yo. Beautiful lady, yo. That kind of Africa lady, yo.
Aye, see.
I sing in the song for Panya.
Aye.
And I dance in the dance for Panya, oh. I would do anything for Panya.
Anything, yeah.
daughter live far from me. She's my fine baby. She's my African lady. Papanya sweet like a chocolate. When she come around, she a heavyweight. She a dance, she a move, immediate. Baby, I am. Aya, what is my baby name? Aya, what is your baby name? I request for my baby girl. Papanya scatter the floor for me.
Thank you, the Lord, for Panya. Too much love I have for you.
Abby?
Hey. Aya, what is my baby name? Aya, what is your baby name? For my baby girl, Panya scattered the floor for me.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Recent developments in Ethiopia, a strategic country in the Horn of Africa, should give cause for some concern. Ethiopia, the country that was never colonized by European powers, except for a brief occupation of Mussolini troops in the prelude to the Second World War, has been a symbol of Africans' independence. That is why the African Union, the Organization of African States, has their headquarters in Addis Ababa. Equally, the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa has its headquarters in Addis Ababa, and so are a number of international institutions. Its longtime emperor, Haile Selassie, provided stability and security during his long reign until in 1977, a military coup ousted the emperor. And the Derg continued to rule in great turmoil until it itself was overthrown in 1991 by the Tigrayan Liberation Movement, and the leader of the Derg, Mengistu, fled Ethiopia and went to Zimbabwe, where he still resides. Now, the leader of the Tigrayan Liberation Movement was a very charismatic leader, Senes Menare. He was fully aware of the difficulties faced by the country, particularly in trying to manage the various ethnic groups. In the first meeting that they had with the groups, they tried to balance the rule by the Tigrayan government, though a coalition, in terms of the other ethnic groups. The first months in 1991 of the Tigrayan rule, many of the Amharic people who were in the civil service and in key government institutions were purged and they had to leave the country. But the people of Oromo, who claimed to be the majority in the country, even though the Amhara people denied that, stayed and began their agitation for political involvement and freedom. Meles Zenawi was praised for his promotion of economic development, but criticized for his denial of democracy and violation of human rights. And now we have seen the consequences of a political dilemma. That is, no minority ethnic group can rule a country for a sustainable period. It is not sustainable, whether it is white minority rule or whatever you want to call it. And this was the problem now faced by Ethiopia. The leader, Haile Mariam, who has just resigned, has been trying to see whether one can relax the political system to accommodate both the Oromo and the Amhara people. But there is also another political phenomenon. When an authoritarian regime tries to relax, this is the very same period when the pressure increases. So despite the fact that the Ethiopian government has been releasing thousands of political prisoners in an attempt to open the political system, demonstrations which began 3 years ago continued and not abated. And therefore, appears to be a division within the government. Although government officials deny this, and the resignation of Prime Minister Haile Mariam would indicate that he belongs to the wing which wants to open up the political system in Ethiopia. And it would seem that he has been defeated by another wing which believes that relaxing the political system will jeopardize the regime. Therefore, it is not surprising that shortly after he resigned, the government has declared a state of emergency, which will not be managed by the military and will last for 6 months. There is no evidence that this declaration of emergency will change things, as the last 10 months did not change anything. So the question then is, what should the government do if they replaced Haile Mariam? It would seem that the government should try for a comprehensive dialogue with all the minority groups, not only with the Oromo or the Amhara groups. And the object should be not a zero-sum game where one side wins all and the others lose anything. It should be a non-zero-sum game where everyone tries to maximize their gain and minimize their loss. There is still a chance to try to reach a political accommodation because a system which denies other ethnic groups such as the Moro and the Amara any kind of political involvement cannot last and cannot be sustained. Despite the fact, this is true, that Ethiopia today is the second most active economic power in Africa, doing very well with its economic growth. But the key should be to open up the system and all the other groups who today feel that they have been disqualified in not giving their proper role in the running of the government. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Saleh, Reporter Douglas Impuga, Producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Mr. Zoniak, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, the hunter does not rub himself in oil and lie by the fireside to sleep. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia Michael Rayner opened a three-day regional U.S. alumni global health workshop on February 6, 2018, in Addis Ababa. The workshop brought together 22 alumni of U.S. government-sponsored exchange programs from Ethiopia, Lesotho, Malawi, Swaziland, and Tanzania, with the aim of sharing best practices for communicating public health information. The workshop also provided participants with tools to promote health-seeking behavior through the use of data and health communication strategies and would support the development of a community of exchange alumni who are active in public health. Ambassador Rayner told the participants, "When we fail to provide for the health of our citizens, we feel the pain beyond the effects of illness itself. We see the harm when children are unable to attend school. We count the cost to families when parents are unable to work. And we endure the lost opportunity of lives cut short and of people marginalized or stigmatized by disease. You're here because you understand these challenges and are already making a difference." The ambassador added, "Like you, the United States has long recognized the importance of a cooperative and multidisciplinary approach to tackling global health challenges. Agencies as diverse as USAID, the Centers for Disease Control, the Peace Corps, the Department of Defense, and State Department's Refugee Bureau are working from a variety of angles to improve the health of people in Africa and around the world. All of these agencies are part of the U.S. Embassy team in Ethiopia, working in close coordination with the Ethiopian government, civil society, non-governmental organizations, and the donor community." Ambassador Rayner told the workshop participants that by the year 2050, Africa's population will exceed 2 billion people, with over 70% below the age of 35. Meeting the needs of 2 billion people is not something any of us can do on our own. The United States is committed to doing our part, but it'll take strong partners and strong leaders like you working here on the continent to get the job done. You will also need each other, which is why gatherings like this one are so important, said Ambassador Rayner. You certainly have my commitment of support and that of my colleagues and government.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.